ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Over summer, I have been revisiting some of your favourite stories from 2025. Today, we'll be discussing how to help our kids or grandkids navigate the world safely. How do you actually talk to your children about their personal safety without scaring them, but still giving them the confidence to make good decisions when you're not around? And then later, a different kind of safety, financial safety. Why we should be talking about money at school and at home. I'll explore some practical ways to help the next generation feel secure, not just physically, but financially too. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. How do you stop a child from committing a crime? It's a million-dollar question, and finding an answer we can all agree on is far from simple. A report has detailed the consequences of getting that answer wrong. The cost of detaining young people in jails or community-based supervision has shot up dramatically in the past 5 years, despite the actual number of people in the system declining. So if getting to these kids too late is costing us both financially and in community safety, just how early do we need to be intervening? High school? Primary school? Kindy? The Queensland government's announced it will build crime prevention high schools, but one of my next guests says you need to start crime prevention when kids are as young as 4. Emeritus Professor Ross Hommel is the now retired Foundation Professor in Criminology and Criminal Justice at Griffith University, who led a decades-long early intervention and early prevention program in Queensland. And Dr. Caroline Krauser-Barlow is the CEO of The Front Project, who co-authored the Cost of Late Intervention report. Ross, I'll start with you. This research you've been doing over decades, I feel like if you've been doing it for this long, we should have it all sorted by now.
Yes, it's one of the more discouraging aspects of this work, that it's taking decades to bring about change. But new reports like the Front Project and many, many others are really putting prevention, the importance of prevention, right up in front. We hear it with mental health. The mental health system will never handle the number of young people in particular who have mental health disorders. We need to basically lay a strong foundation for healthy child and youth development. That's the best we can do to give kids the best chance of having a good life.
Caroline, the top line of your report is basically that it's costing us more to help fewer kids. What's going on here?
Yeah, so one of the big drivers of the increased in costs has been what's called community-based supervision. And actually, in some ways, it's a good sign, because what we're seeing is state governments investing more in probationary and diversionary programs, so more kind of intensive support for kids once they've hit that youth justice system, in terms of kind of, I guess, what you might call rehabilitation or building those life skills that might support them going forward. It also, of course, reflects kind of increased intensive supervision as well, and more electronic supervision. So we're seeing a lot more kind of, electronic tagging of children as we go. And so that's why the cost is going up. But clearly the cost, all of those investments would be made much better, much earlier in a child's life.
I think we can agree that if something has a cost, maybe that's an appropriate cost, but you're saying there's more cost-effective ways of helping kids.
Yeah, absolutely. So, There's been some really interesting studies done of children and youth justice. So most recently, the Kids Institute did a study of around 100 kids in youth justice, and they discovered that 9 in 10 of those kids had a serious neurodevelopmental impairment, and about a third of them have fetal alcohol syndrome, and that those had not been diagnosed or supported before. And similarly, when you look in terms of New South Wales has had a look at children who are 10 to 13 in court, and they found, you know, 91% of those kids have been flagged by child protection as at risk, 40% had needed homelessness services, and 3/4 had parents who've been through the courts themselves. So what we can see is that children ending up in youth justice have actually been let down by the systems that are supposed to support them much earlier in their lives.
So what you're seeing is we're treating symptoms and not the root problem.
Yeah, exactly right. And I mean, I think it makes intuitive sense to people to think about, you know, a child with unmet developmental needs, struggles at school, they act out, they're suspended, they fall further behind, the school door closes, you know, just as family pressures like poverty and homelessness and all of those things mount. And so, you know, like I know that it can be easy sometimes to think that we're talking about mini Tony Sopranos. In fact, when we're talking about kids in youth justice, what we're really seeing is kids who are experiencing stress from all the different parts of their lives, and the offending is just the really pointy tip of some really deep-seated cycles of need that have been unmet on the way.
So, Ross, this report's about what happens when we don't intervene, but the work that you've done starting 25 years ago was really about what can happen when we get to kids early.
Yeah, and as I said before, laying a strong foundation for positive development. That's really how we frame what we did. We had funding initially from a foundation that was interested, surprisingly, in the problem of youth crime. So preventing crime was always a focus, but we didn't talk much about that. We talked about, as I said, positive development of children and child well-being. And what we did, we worked with a disadvantaged community in Brisbane early on in the early 2000s. And we spent a whole 12 months just learning about that community, talking to a lot of people, including the school teachers, the preschool teachers, and other service providers. And parents, residents. We employed local students to develop and administer a survey. We were trying to find out what the community thought were the needs of children. And one of the things that came through most strongly was what Carol has just mentioned, the multi-problem families, the problem of poverty and the links between poverty and the whole range of issues that she mentioned. The other that was particularly emphasised by the preschool teachers was children's language and speech language and communication skills. They had noticed a very strong link between children who couldn't articulate, couldn't understand many words, even if English was their native language, these are four-year-olds, and their subsequent poor behaviour, again, as Carolyn mentioned. And there was quite a literature, particularly on the link between poor communication skills in preschool children, their readiness for school and their ability to flourish at school, particularly with, well, reading and writing, but also numeracy, surprisingly, perhaps. That link between school failure, being not ready for school, and the acting out, again, as Carolyn said, was also quite clearly documented in good research by the time we were developing this project. So really on the initiative of the Department of Education teachers that were talking to us, we were able to recruit the help of specialised communication teachers within the education system who themselves, on the basis of a postgraduate course that they'd done, a one-year postgrad course in service training at Griffith University Education, they were able to design and deliver over a two-year period an enriched preschool program, which focused on speech, language and communication skills. It was preceded by thorough measurement of the language level of the child, and we found in a nutshell that there was a significant increase in their language skills at the end of the 12 months. It was a 30-week program, almost over the whole preschool year, Not only was there improvement in communication skills, as measured by the standardised test that was administered before and after, but there were very significant improvements in behaviour. Surprise, surprise. Now, the important thing is that those behavioural improvements were sustained throughout primary school. And when we got permission some years ago to link the data that we'd collected on the children and their families anonymously with youth justice records, we found more than a 50% reduction in the onset of serious or court-adjudicated youth crime by the age of 17. Quite a substantial effect. And the really interesting thing, that communication intervention for four-year-olds administered by professional, skilled teachers, I have to emphasise that, when combined with a very holistic, supportive form of family support that was offered through our community partner, Mission Australia, there was a zero rate of offending in that group. The subgroup of children who had done the communication program, whose parents also participated in the family support program, had a zero rate of offending, which is a remarkable result. I'm still not quite sure I fully believe it. But we actually do, I think, understand some of the mechanisms. And it was the tight integration of what went on in the home in terms of developing an enriched learning environment, as simple as mum reading to the kids at home. And what went on in the preschool, the integration of those two settings turned out to be absolutely fundamental to the positive results that we observed.
You are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking with Emeritus Professor Ross Hommel from Griffith University and Dr. Caroline Crozier-Barlow, who's the CEO of the Front Project, who's just published a new report into the increasing costs of basically youth crime and the outworking of that. One person says any prevention starts with parental responsibility and, if necessary, penalties for them not taking responsibility for behaviour of their children. Support and training for parents who are failing may help in some cases, as well as parenting and family issues options courses in schools. Ross, parenting. Some people have a really tight family with parents who are able to give this support. Some people don't.
Well, that's absolutely right. Look, I'm a great believer in parents taking responsibility, and it turns out all the parents we worked with wanted to. Even the heroin addicted mums and the ones with violent alcoholic partners and the terrible situation some of those families were in, all of those parents wanted the best outcome for their children. They didn't want for the child the sort of outcome they were experiencing as a young adult. Look, we're hardwired as a species, I think, for punishment responses. Effectively, what we're doing with the criminalisation of poor child behaviour is punishing poverty. And that, again, is in the Front report. And the consequences of poverty. Now, I talk almost exclusively about early prevention. And that, as I said before, is about not early intervention. I just want to make that. We did not target children with problems or children with poor language skills. Their needs were catered for through a specialised form of input that was graded to the level of their language development. But we worked across the whole school system, preschool system, which was part of the primary school system in those days. And I think that's a really crucial point. We're working to improve the well-being of all children in the community, and that includes, so it turns out there's a bigger impact of universal interventions on the most at-risk children and families. Look, I could talk all day about this, but I think your respondent's question or response about accountability is a very understandable way of thinking about it. But as I said, I'll just repeat, parents want to be responsible, they want to be accountable, they need help, particularly in those early years and particularly in high poverty, high crime, violent settings. I just can't underline the importance of that. We're much better investing in prevention than we are in punishment.
Caroline, what does that look like from your perspective with the Front Project?
Yeah, so I really endorse what Ross is saying about the need to sort of build out and strengthen our universally available and community-based services. So the Murdoch Children's Research Institute has laid out a pathway for us in something called Restacking the Odds. And what they talk about is how maternal and child health home visits really high quality early learning, local primary school that supports effective transition. We know that coming into primary school can be a tricky moment where kids start to disengage, supported play groups and parenting programs. When all of these places are set up to notice early, respond quickly, and walk alongside families, what we see is that they prevent escalation of behaviours and escalation of concerns. So I know it must sound a little bit kind of trite, but, you know, a supported playgroup isn't just songs and blocks. What you find in those environments is that you find a parent who can find connection with other parents in a similar situation, and we know that that social capital is really important in enabling parents to problem solve rather than kind of cycling into kind of increasing poor home environments. We find children getting the kind of extra stimulation they need and professionals who are able to step in early. So I think at the moment we have an extraordinary opportunity in Australia at the moment because we've got governments at both state and Commonwealth levels looking to make big investments in universal early learning, and as well as in things like healthy child development. So you will have heard Minister Butler talk a couple of weeks ago about something called Thriving Kids. And I think what those big investments are is that they are ways of sort of stop seeing kids as things that need to be fixed over there and instead investing in the adults who are around kids most of the time, the parents, the educators, the teachers. And if we can invest in those, and that's where kids spend most of their time and it's where their brains are growing and it's where they're learning all of these skills, then actually, as Ross's work so powerfully shows, we can really set kids up for a much better trajectory in life.
We're talking so much about early years here. It's so interesting to sort of think about the issues that we see mostly in, I suppose, teenagers and young adults starting here. Ross, we've seen in Queensland the Crisafulli government's announced 3 crime prevention schools in Townsville, Ipswich and Rockhampton. These are obviously high schools, year 7 to 12. Is this too late?
Well, look, the mantra of the criminologist is never too early, never too late. It's never too late to introduce supportive services, getting kids back on track. So essentially I support these, what I can read about the crime prevention schools. Let me just emphasise, though, that there's been huge efforts put in through the Department of Education and through other systems for the education of kids in detention or in community-based supervision, although we have increasing numbers in Queensland of kids actually locked up, and that's the current reality, 90% of whom, I should add, are not sentenced.
Do you want to unpack that a bit?
Well, they're on remand. They haven't yet, their court case hasn't come up yet. 90% of all the children in youth detention are not sentenced. They may have a long previous history, but for the current offence or offences, they haven't had their day in court. So that means actually the legal powers to, you can't require kids who haven't been, as it were, they don't use the word convicted, but found guilty of the an offence to do anything. Now, most do, I gather. The real problem is resourcing. One of my issues with the crime prevention schools is that it doesn't really acknowledge the enormous efforts that have already gone in. I know some of the trained education department teachers who do this sort of work with kids in detention, and it's really positive. So yes, let's have more of it. I don't know whether special crime prevention schools is the way to go. We'll have to find out. I would like to see this very rigorously and independently evaluated. I mean, one of the things that really, really annoys me about government, and this is true for Labor and LNP, you know, they're talking about a decade of skyrocketing youth offending. It's highly politicised. Look, can we get away from that? I mean, it isn't. It's just wrong. We don't have skyrocketing youth offending under Labor. It was going down and it's still going down. In fact, fewer kids than ever in this country are getting into trouble with the police. That's the bottom line. Anyway, look, as you could gather, I could get really steamed up on this and go all day. Yes, basically, I endorse this initiative. They're certainly making the right sorts of noises. The schools will deliver structured and supportive environments that combine tailored learning with life skills development. But let it be integrated as much as possible with the community the children will have to return to. And that's one of my issues with special schools, that they could be isolated and labelled.
Knowing that you're in the crime prevention high school or that your kid's going to the crime prevention high school feels a little pointed.
Yeah.
So, Caroline, from your perspective and based on the findings of your report that you've just released, what would you like to see happen next?
Yeah, so I think to Ross's point, what we know is that actually our education systems and our health systems often have some really helpful pathways that can take us through. So I was thinking as Ross was talking about schools I know in South Australia who started doing basic reading screeners of kids entering high school and discovering that in some of those really low SES areas, as many as 70 to 80% of kids don't have basic literacy skills. And then we're surprised that they're having trouble sitting still in classroom and not acting out. So I think schools and early learning services and maternal child and health services, all of these services actually have instincts about how to support children effectively to build out those skills and to support their families. I think what we need to do is we need to take seriously the idea that we're going to have to enrich these universal systems. And I know that feels impossibly big. I know it feels like, well, how on earth can we get all of our schools and all of our early learning centres to be able to provide these sort of extra supports around communication development? I think what our report shows is that the cost of doing it the way we're doing it now is much, much higher. And we're not just seeing that in youth justice, we're seeing that in child protection, we're seeing that in the flight of families of children with developmental delay or autism turning to the NDIS, even though it's not super well designed for sort of early childhood intervention, because they don't trust that their community-based services, the things that they use every day, will be there to help when they need. So I think for me, what I am really heartened by is I'm hearing both the Commonwealth and the states talk about investing big in our big universal services to enable that kind of enriched and progressive response to the needs of children. So that's what I'm hoping for, and I'm really looking forward to some more work on that in the coming year.
Caroline, Ross, thank you both so much. Dr. Caroline Krauser-Barlow is the CEO of the Front Project, who co-authored the Cost of Late Intervention Report. And Emeritus Professor Ross Hommel is the now retired Foundation Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Griffith University, who led a decades-long early intervention and early prevention program in Queensland. Well, coming up here on Life Matters, in the wake of multiple failings in our childcare system, we'll tell you how to be the safe place for your children to come to with worries. Last year, we saw some horrific failings in Australia's childcare system. Serious issues throughout the industry exposed gaps in regulations, which left some children the victims of abuse by staff. The government's worked to put better systems in place. That part of that is a national register for workers. But maybe you're still finding drop-off time a bit harder than you used to. The reality is we can't protect our kids from the world forever, but we can do everything in our power to be their safe person and check in when something might be wrong. There are ways to create opportunities for them to open up to you. Well, Dr. Rachel Sharman is a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of the Sunshine Coast. She specialises in child and adolescent development, and she's with me now. Rachel, thanks for joining me.
No worries at all.
So we're talking about really young kids here, kids in daycare from babies up to around 4 years. If we want to create a relationship with our kids where they feel comfortable disclosing things to us, where do we start?
So look, I think the first thing is being open to those disclosures. So having, you know, asking questions, having conversations, opening up that possibility that they can tell you things. So, you know, having a conversation around the dinner table or at bedtime before bed, even, you know, on the way home from daycare in the car, these are all really good spaces to just, you know, what happened today? How was it? Did anything bad happen? Did anything good happen? And just sort of getting kids used to just telling you stuff without fear of you, you know, reacting in a way that they're going to find a little bit concerning.
So the reacting is also a big part of this.
Look, it really is. So, I mean, I can't sort of emphasise this enough. Kids really do sort of take their lead from their parents. There's a bit of, emotional contagion that can happen here. So if they tell you something bad happens and, you perhaps, have a reaction to that, a bit of an emotional reaction, even just raising your voice and, what? How did that happen? Oh, my God. Yeah. If you do that sort of stuff, the kids will sort of bounce off on that and they'll wonder if they did the right thing. You know, are they in trouble? I know that sounds a little bit unbelievable from a parental point of view or even an adult point of view, but the second an adult sort of has a bit of a reaction that a child finds perhaps confusing, they will often assume that they are the one who has caused that and they are at fault, and therefore they are at fault for telling you this. So it is really important that people do work their hardest to moderate their reactions and just come at these conversations with a genuine sort of curiosity about how the day went.
What if something bad actually did happen?
Yeah, so look, if children disclose something that's really quite alarming, the first thing to do is to really try and hold on to your emotion about that, okay? So again, we don't want to put the child off by telling you more by having a reaction that the child might find concerning or scary. So it really is just following up with some, sort of follow-up questions about what really did happen, what went on there, and, asking the questions just that genuinely sort of curious fashion. Without sort of getting too emotional or potentially getting too angry. And look, don't forget, sometimes kids will tell you something that originally sounds really, really terrible, but in fact, when you unpack it, it's really quite boring. So kids have a way of using language that might not be quite what parents assume the meaning to be.
Yeah, fair enough. Also, we're talking about quite young kids in this conversation, kids at daycare under four. Sometimes they don't have the language to tell you what's happening. Are there other ways you can be looking out for just what to be concerned about?
Yeah, look, absolutely. In fact, children all the way up to sort of upper primary, so all the way up to about 12, they're still developing their verbal skills, their articulation abilities, all that kind of stuff. And as we've mentioned, sort of that conversational sort of behaviour and ability as well. So kids right up to that sort of 12-year-old age tend to sometimes manifest stress physically, yeah? So really common in younger kids. And, I mean, a lot of parents would be familiar with kids who perhaps start wetting the bed again and, weird stuff when things are stressful, if you're moving house or if something's going on at the home. So those are all the signs still to look out for. It's that physical manifestation of stress. So they could be complaining of a sore tummy. They could be constantly complaining that they don't want to go. Giving you sort of physical signs and signals and bodily functions all going awry, all of a sudden the toilet trained kid isn't toilet trained anymore, all that sort of stuff. It's not necessarily a sign that something sinister is going on, because as I said, all stress will do this to kids, and just something like moving to a new daycare room could be stressful for some children. So we don't want to sort of overinterpret these sorts of things, but definitely you want to follow up if a child is manifesting physical signs of stress.
What sort of follow-up would you recommend there?
So I think it's really useful to try and talk to the people around the kids. Is there an obvious reason? Have they just moved rooms and it's a new teacher and it's a new group, and maybe you've got one of those little cautious sort of slow-to-warm-up babies or slow-to-warm-up toddlers that find change really difficult? So it's about knowing your own child. But likewise, if you've normally got a really sort of happy, extroverted kid who doesn't actually, there's nothing really going on, and all of a sudden they're manifesting these signs, it's that kind of all of a sudden with no apparent reason that I think is worth following up with people.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, and I'm talking to Dr. Rachel Sharman about how to foster trust with your kids so that if they're worried about something or if something is going wrong, that they know you're a safe person to come and talk to. Rachel, how do we teach kids about what is acceptable behaviour and when something that's happening to them is wrong?
Yeah, so we often talk to kids about sort of feelings. Did this give you a bad feeling? So like I said before, kids tend to manifest these things physically. So they might talk about feeling sick in the gut, or they, you know, something made them feel sort of sad or upset. So talking about feelings is really important. And, you know, did something happen today that made you feel bad? That's a really good sort of conversation starter if people are concerned. I know some parents even just before bedtime, sort of after the book's been read, say something along the lines of, tell me one good thing that happened today and one not so good thing that happened today, or one bad thing. And again, it's opening up that sort of conversation about what might be going on for the child.
How do you lay the groundwork with kids without going in too strong and making them maybe fear that adults might do inappropriate things, or avoiding a kid becoming fixated on sort of the worst case scenario?
Yeah, look, and I think daycare centres, most really good quality daycare centres and kindies are good about this. You'll find pretty quickly that your child will start to talk about private parts, for example. So a lot of the daycares and kindies are really across this. They teach this themselves, okay? So, yeah, teaching your kids about private parts, and they're called private for a reason. You know, they're there for the toilet and something, you know, get basic. You've got to get basic with a two-year-old. This is what our private parts are for. That's actually something you can start very, very early on. And that, yeah, we keep them under clothes unless we're going to the toilet or having a shower and that kind of thing. These are conversations that fortunately a lot of daycares and kindies have, and these are conversations that you can continue at home as well.
I don't want to get too heavy, but the reality is that the reason we're having this conversation is because bad things have happened to children. There is mandatory disclosure laws that even apply to parents.
Mm-hmm. Correct. So in Queensland, and we do need to remember this is state-based, okay, but some people might have even noticed the ads about this on television. So in Queensland, it is now mandatory for any person over the age of 18 years who reasonably suspects that a child has been sexually abused or is being sexually abused to report that directly to police, unless they have what's known as a reasonable excuse. And I'll let, you know, people go to the website and get lost in all that sort of stuff. But yeah, as a sort of a prima facie, as a general kind of, as a general first port of call, every adult in Queensland is now expected to report directly to police if they have any suspicions that a child is being sexually abused.
When these kind of conversations come up, it can make you question whether you should send your kid to daycare at all. But there are so many benefits from early childhood education that I think kind of bear repeating in this environment, Rachel.
Yeah, look, absolutely. So first of all, you know, this is a reminder that we are, of course, talking about high quality early childcare education. There is a really wide spectrum out there, which is hugely problematic. And really, I think that it's great that we've kicked off a conversation potentially with regulators and governments, like who's watching the watchers here? You know, what is going on? Why do we have such low care or problematic childcare centres being allowed to operate and people not being informed? So that's one issue. But in terms of our high-quality childcare education centres, they really give children the opportunity to socialise. I mentioned previously, we don't live in an environment where kids grow up with five other siblings their age. You know, there's usually one or two children in most households now with a few years apart. So that opportunity for kids to socialise with same-age peers is so important for their development. And, of course, a good quality, you know, childcare centre with a genuine early education approach will be doing just that. They will be providing, you know, stimulating early education for your child, which is quite helpful.
Rachel, thank you so much for sharing your insights.
Thank you.
Dr. Rachel Sharman is a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of the Sunshine Coast. Well, coming up, kids aren't being taught about money at school. I'll tell you how to broach the topic so that they can save and spend responsibly and stay out of financial trouble.
Christopher Skase, you might remember that name, the high-flying businessman turned fugitive. You may even remember parts of the Skase saga, like this.
Andrew Denton's chase for Skase.
Or this.
Enrolls Skase in a wheelchair with an oxygen mask.
Well, now you can get your head around the full story. I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Personal question. How much do you have in your super account right this very second? If you honestly have no idea, you're not alone. One of the big four banks has done a survey and found that a third of Australians have no idea how big or small their retirement nest egg is. And it gets worse. Nearly half of us avoid money conversations altogether, and young people are particularly tight-lipped. Yet that generation seems to have no problem talking about literally anything else. What students do say is that they don't get taught enough about money at school. And if it's not being talked about at home either, where are young people meant to learn how to save and spend responsibly? Well, Deb Schrute is from Financial Counselling Australia. Deb, welcome back to Life Matters.
Thanks, Tegan. Good morning. Good to be here.
I'm not going to ask you your super balance, but I'm pretty sure you know what it is.
Maybe ballpark.
Okay. But these survey results, are they ringing true with what you're seeing with the clients that you work with?
Absolutely. So I think we see this across the board. And if we are to break this down into why this is the case, I would say financial literacy, it goes beyond just budgeting and your super balance. If we're to use a mobile phone as an example, which most people have, all the decisions that need to be made that go into choosing the right mobile phone, do you get a contract, do you get a pay as you go, what is the best phone for you, do you get direct debit, do you pay in advance? There are just so many different elements that go into that decision that also feed through to your budget and your finances.
So that's a really complicated decision to make. Are you saying that we have more decisions like that to make than previous generations, or that's just sort of an illustrative case study?
So there is potential that there are more decisions to make than previous generations. Life does seem to be getting more and more complex, and there are more and more products out there. I also think that it could be because we have access to more information as well, that you can get this overwhelm. And people generally do try and go out to educate themselves about financial literacy and contracts and all sorts of information. But because there is so much out there, it's really hard to know what the trusted sources are. And we see clients really try their best to work out what the next best step forward is and how to get out of their situations. But they come across some really not good quality or independent quality sources of information during that process.
What kind of places, like social media?
There's social media, finfluencers, there's a lot of chat forums. So, for example, general mums chat forums on Facebook, for example, there's people asking very specific financial information on there. And there's random strangers responding and who knows what qualifications these people have, if any.
What is it? I don't think that previous generations were like coming out of the womb knowing about financial literacy. Are we really failing our kids now, or is it a function of just young people be young?
I think that just generally, there's always been this responsibility for parents to be teaching their children financial literacy and these types of skills. And I think that that's a lot of pressure to put on parents. Firstly, do they have the skills to teach it? Secondly, we're assuming that every child is in a situation where they have that sort of security and knowledge surrounding them. But also, something like financial literacy, it's very values driven. So what might be seen as a good decision by one person or good management of your finances by one person might look very different to another. And as an example, I'll use the, if you had a choice and it was to send your child to a private school or to keep the house, there's no right decision in what to do. Some people will choose to send their child to a public school and, you know, keep ownership of their house, where others will choose to rent and send their child to a private school. So it's very value-driven decision, and there's no right or wrong answer.
So it's not so much about being prescriptive, but giving people the tools to make those calculations for themselves.
100%. And this is also why we can't look at financial literacy in that two-dimensional way, because it's this whole ecosystem that intertwines. And this is where it can be overwhelming, and sometimes there's no easy answers to it.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Deb Schroot from Financial Counselling Australia about how a new survey has found that young people especially just don't have a good grasp on financial literacy, but a third of Australians also don't know their super balance, so maybe it's not just the youngsters. One person says financial literacy is taught in schools. It's just becoming more and more difficult to teach and for kids to learn because many behaviour issues in class time makes it hard for understanding to be developed. Jilly says, my grandchildren are learning lessons from a financial literacy book for children by Scott Pape. They keep a third, save a third, and give a third away. It teaches the child so much. Deb, what kind of lessons do you think young people need to be taught in schools and at home?
Well, firstly, to the point that you made at the beginning about talking about money in the first place and why people don't talk about it. So I think that talking about it, having it out in the open, taking the shame away from not knowing or not having enough money, and having really honest conversations in general, whether that be with friends, family, and so on. This is a good way to get rid of the stigma in the first place, because, you know, putting our head in the sand and, you know, not wanting to learn about these things, which unfortunately we all need to deal with, is usually not very constructive. There are a lot of financial literacy programs out there. So, for example, Extra Foundation have their Talk Money program in schools, but unfortunately it's not in every school. So, I guess the funding only stretches so far, and the engagement from schools only stretches so far. There are, you know, lots of financial literacy programs in communities, but again, can everyone access them? The other thing is to, I guess, know what the best sources of information are, and they're usually ones which are independent. A lot of resources which are out there on the web and wider, some of them are good quality and some of them are being used as a bit of a carrot to sell a product. So they might be disguised as really good quality information, but there's another motive to that information being out there. So going to sources such as Centrelink has a financial literacy page, ASIC Money Smart, so all government run organisations, National Debt Helpline, I need to mention, which has a lot of information about debts and other types of financial resources. That would be a really good start, is just to look for that good quality independent information.
Was one person on the text line saying they're learning about financial literacy from specialists on YouTube and podcasts, and they say it's easily accessible and it's entertaining. I haven't visited the ASIC website regularly. It's great, but it's not YouTube.
I completely agree with you on that. And if there are any money smart creatives out there listening, I think it wouldn't do any harm to make the information on the website more interactive. I'm not saying there's not good quality podcasts out there, but you really need to do your research to see which ones are good quality, the qualifications of the people who are giving the information. Are they connected to, for example, financial institutions, or are they trying to sell products? Are they sponsored? How independent is this information that they're giving, and are they being influenced in how they're selling their advice?
I'm talking to
Easy
Deb.
Question.
Yeah, sorry, Deb. Deb Schroot from Financial Counselling Australia is sharing her insider tips, well, not insider trading, just tips, with us here on Life Matters on Radio National. Is it harder to teach financial literacy now, Deb, because we're not working with physical cash very often anymore. I feel like I learnt, you know, if you give someone a $10 note and then they give you back $2 in change, you're like, I'm really seeing that transaction happening. Whereas now I just merrily tap my card on thing. I wonder if it's harder for kids to understand financial literacy because they don't have these physical artifacts in the same way.
I think that could be part of it. But in saying that, we're getting rid of the physical money, but there are a lot of other tools out there that are to help that maybe we didn't have in the past as well. So there might be different apps, or we're able to track things on our phone. We're able to look at statements and transactions easier and, you know, see running balances in real time. So I think it is... there is definitely a benefit to having the physical visual that we had with money, but I think it's about us also shifting, because we need to accept the fact that, you know, we are becoming more cashless by the day, and embracing other tools out there and what are the other strategies and methods that we're able to use to manage the situation. And yeah, just adjusting to that.
Actually, as you're saying that, Erica has texted in saying, I started very late in life. I've developed a spreadsheet which tells me what bills and donations I have to pay by when. So that visual cue that you've created for yourself, as you're saying there, Deb. Erica says, I now put substantial funds into separate savings accounts every month. I pay my credit card in full every month. If I had started this system at the start of my adult life, I would now be well off and able to enjoy a comfortable retirement instead of having to keep working to pay for the reckless spending of my younger days. We've talked a lot about young people, Deb, but is it too late if you're an adult or you're approaching retirement and you're only learning these lessons now?
It's never too late to learn. And even if you're finding that you have maybe not been happy with the choices that you've made along the way, it is never too late to learn about what the best way to manage your finances are for you. Because as I said before, it's a very values-driven decision. And I also need to say that if you are having trouble with debt, there is help available, and it's also never too late to get help as well. The National Debt Helpline, the Bond Line, 1-800-007-007 or ndh.org.au, has an array of information on different debts, what you can do if you find that you are struggling in your situation. And also there's someone to talk to. If you do feel that there, you know, shameful talking to your friends or family about your situation, financial counsellors are free, independent and confidential and are there to listen to you.
Deb Schroot is from Financial Counselling Australia.
Hey, it's Anthony Burke here. Radio National presents The Homefront. Housing in Australia is under pressure. The crisis is real. But could better design be part of the fix? I'm Anthony Burke, and in The Homefront, we explore how the great Australian dream is shifting and what we could do to build a better future. To hear The Homefront, search Radio National Presents on the ABC Listen app.
Well, sticking with the money trend, it's time for My Two Cents, where I ask the questions you'd rather not answer about money. And today, I'm finding out whether it's raining cash in the world of ABC weather presenter Nate Byrne.
My name's Nate Byrne, and I make money by being ridiculously adorable on television. Oh, I'm also the weatherman. My last three purchases were a video game, 3 litres of milk, and coffee, which means that I'm a caffeinated, very strong-boned gamer. When I got my first pay, I spent it on a magazine, because back in the day, you kind of had to do that in order to get photos of famous people, and I wanted a poster to stick on my wall. When I was growing up, money was tight. It was every cent was counted and accounted for, and we really had no extra to go around. So we always talked about money as quite openly, in my family, and it was always something to be reserved and carefully monitored. The biggest thing I've had to unlearn about money as an adult is that it's actually okay to spend it. I am a chronic saver, and I still do that to this day. I don't make many purchases at all. I'm pretty tight with my money. I like to spend it on experiences. But one of the ones I probably most regret, I've got a killer pair of high heels that look amazing, but completely destroyed my feet running up Oxford Street this year. I have a very lucky housing situation. I've got a partner who I pay lots of money to stay with, but I don't actually rent. I am on the lookout for a house. Do you know of a bargain? The biggest lie I tell myself about money is that it's really kind of scary and that it's something you have to hoard. I don't know, for some reason, investing feels like gambling, and I know that's not right exactly, but it's a really hard thing to shake. The last time I worried about my bank balance was a really long time ago. I've been very, very lucky, but maybe in the weekend when I left the Royal Australian Navy on the Friday and was starting with the ABC on the Monday, because it was just the most uncertain I'd ever been that I was going to have a job. I was 2 days unemployed. That was terrifying. I use a credit card all the time. I have a tiny, tiny little amount that you can put on it, but I kind of get up to there every few weeks and then just put a little bit of extra money on it. I do that because I want the points. I get points. See, I love collecting things. Points are like money. The more you have, the better. I also never spend my points on anything. I've got like 500,000 frequent flyers for some reason. When it comes to money and family, I've really tried my whole adult life to avoid being given anything by my parents. It was a matter of pride. I even got to a point when I was at university, I'd moved out of home, and I was making decisions between putting petrol into my moped or buying food rather than asking my parents for help. The biggest decision I've ever had to make about money is being made as we speak. I finally got a deposit together for a house, and I am fighting with myself because, you know, that bank account has been going up and up and up slowly for so long now. I'm terrified to see it go back down, but I know it'll be for the best. So I'm literally in this decision right now. Check back in later. My financial goals are not to be rich and wealthy beyond my wildest dreams. I just want to be safe and comfortable and to be able to look after my friends and family as best I can. But if I was to become rich, that would be amazing. I would probably end up giving half of it away though, because I think if you've got a lot of money, there's a lot of good you could do in the world. If I won the lottery, I would still rock up to be on ABC News Breakfast the next morning and the morning after. And the morning after that. I think I'd probably get a weather wall installed in my home though, so I could do a work from home once in a while. I'm Nate Byrne, and that's my 2 cents.
That's ABC weather presenter Nate Byrne there. Well, earlier I spoke about what's really needed to stop kids from committing crimes and how early intervention is needed.
What we did, we worked with a disadvantaged community in Brisbane early on in the early 2000s, and we spent a whole 12 months just learning about that community. We were trying to find out what the community thought were the needs of children. And one of the things that came through most strongly was what Carol has just mentioned, the multi-problem families, the problem of poverty and the links between poverty and the whole range of issues that she mentioned. The other that was particularly emphasised by the preschool teachers was children's speech, language and communication skills. They had noticed a very strong link between children who couldn't articulate, couldn't understand many words, even if English was their native language. These are four-year-olds, and their subsequent poor behaviour. That link between school failure failure, being not ready for school, and the acting out, again, as Carolyn said, was also quite clearly documented in good research by the time we were developing this project. So really, on the initiative of the Department of Education teachers, they were able to design and deliver over a two-year period an enriched preschool program, which focused on speech, language and communication skills. It was preceded by thorough measurement of the language level of the child, and we found in a nutshell that there was a significant increase in their language skills at the end of the 12 months. It was a 30-week program, almost over the whole preschool year. And not only was there improvement in communication skills as measured by the standardised test that was administered before and after, but there were very significant improvements in behaviour. Surprise, surprise. Now, the important thing is that those behavioural improvements were sustained throughout primary school. And when we got permission some years ago to link the data that we'd collected on the children and their families anonymously with youth justice records, we found more than a 50% reduction in the onset of serious or court-adjudicated youth crime by the age of 17.
That was Emeritus Professor Ross Hommel, the now-retired Foundation Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Griffith University. Ross led a decades-long early intervention and early prevention program in Queensland. Well, that's it today for Life Matters on ABC Radio National. You can catch up on any of our stories on the ABC Listen app, and I'll catch you again tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.